Bonjour à tous. Mesdames et messieurs, bonjour. Merci à Philippe Walter pour l'aimable invitation. Je vais reprendre les mots de Jean-Louis Andral, directeur du musée Picasso à Antibes, dans l'introduction de notre livre Picasso Express. Que Picasso ait choisi en 1912 pour peindre le drapeau français dans une vue du port du Havre, d'utiliser du Ripollin, cette lac qui avait à peu près le même âge que lui, soit une petite trentaine d'années d'existence, peut apparaître rétrospectivement comme une sorte de déclaration de guerre supplémentaire après la rupture radicale du cubisme, quant au vocabulaire traditionnel des formes, à la syntaxe même de la peinture. Fin de citation. Aujourd'hui, je ne vous parlerai pas de guerre contre la peinture académique, mais je vais vous raconter les colorful affairs entre Picasso et la peinture Ripollin. Et pour que vous ne soyez pas les victimes de ma guerre personnelle avec la langue française, je vais continuer mon exposé en anglais. Picasso is certainly one of the pioneers of the avant-garde in his masterful manipulation of materials. We see him here at La Californie in 1956 in the south of France, and probably many of you in looking at this picture are probably, your gaze is probably drawn to Picasso's gaze, la mirada fuerte, this gaze that really could capture all the people around him. But for people like me, who are interested in color and the chemistry of paint, the first thing I look at is there. I can see pots of paint. And when you start looking at photographs of Picasso's studios, especially after the 40s, you see many of these kinds of paints. And surely at the end of this lecture, if you're not familiar with it, which many, many in France, of course, are very familiar with, you'll start recognizing cans of Ripollin paint, Le Ripollin, and other brands of paints on these occasional chairs and tables that Picasso used as real palettes, and that his assistant, Jean Sebartes, sometimes commented at some point the paint would become so encrusted that he had to remove the newsprint with the paint and place another one on top. Picasso is also quite extraordinary because he continued to use Ripollin and enamel paints for a long time in his career. And in fact, here we see the beautiful Chateau of Vauvenargues, which just a few summers ago opened its door to the public, where, of course, Picasso and his last wife, Jacqueline, are buried. And if you look on the table, again, you see Ripollin and other brands, Triton, Avi, and also some cans of Cassoulet. We know of Picasso's use of Ripollin because of receipts in the archives, because of photographs of Picasso's studio, as you can see here, where we become pretty adept at this point at spotting the three men in the white lab coat of Ripollin. There are also some very important archival documents, in particular, this letter to Kammweiler, his dealer, dated to the 17th of June of 1912, where Picasso said, "Vous me dites que Oude n'aime pas les tableaux derniers de moi où il y a du Ripollin et des drapeaux. Peut-être nous arriverons à dégoûter tout le monde et nous ne avons pas tout dit." And this is a really important moment. Picasso had been painting with in the spring of 1912. And very famously, we know this from an account of another painter friend, Gino Severini. He came to the studio when Picasso was showing these paintings to his friend, Georges Braque. And Braque, who actually was the son of a sign painter who was part of the trade, famously said, I see the weapons have changed. So art historians are thinking that there probably was not only an avant-garde gest, but also this kind of slightly revolutionary approach in Picasso's integration of common enamel paints in his work. And then later on, Gertrude Stein, in her autobiography of Alice Toklas, reports how Picasso would talk about Repollin as la santé de couleur, a good health for paint. We also have anecdotal evidence that Picasso had Repollin in his atelier, and this is a small sculpture that we have in the collection of the Art Institute in Chicago. And this was a recent discovery. Sometimes you look but you don't see, and we saw that actually the face of this figure is a lid of a Repollin can of paint, and the base is actually a box of Lefranc paint tubes. So this is really a very interesting dialogue between the traditional means of the artist and the new materials. Our focus at the Art Institute for many years has been the study of Picasso's use of enamel paints, specifically Repollin paints. But as I said, many avant-garde artists of the time use this material, Kandinsky, the futurist, the Italian futurist, Miró, Picabia, Magritte, Le Corbusier, and also naive artists like Séraphin de Senlis. I often have to add this slide when I talk to American audiences to explain how important Repollin was as a brand of paint. Certainly in France, but also in the world. Certainly this slide is not needed here. It's interesting how we still find vestiges of the Repollin brand all around France. This is a picture that I took in Marseille a few summers ago. And not only Repollin became so famous that it actually became a word, Ripolliné. And it became synonymous of enamel paint in general, a little bit like right now, each one of us would say, oh, I'll Google it, making a verb of something that, because the word is so famous. And the architect, modernist architect and artist, Le Corbusier, even theorized the loi of Repollin and said that it was a moral act to paint everything white with Repollin. As probably many of you know, Repollin was a Société Anonyme Française de Peinture, and it was established in 1897 outside of Paris in Issy-les-Moulineaux. And actually, the Lefranc factory bought some of the patents from Holland. The inventor of this process is Mr. Rip, and actually, the name comes from Rip, the inventor, and either Oli or Lin, the linseed oil that Philippe also talked extensively about. I'm really indebted to Marcel Lefranc, who gave us a few more details about the arrangements. And in fact, the Lefranc company gave to the Repollin company the processes to work the binding media. And the two enterprises were so linked that actually many members of the Lefranc factory were in the board of the Repollin factory. And here you can see already how prominent the advertisement was at the beginning of the 20th century. And probably we don't realize how groundbreaking these paints were, because right now it's so common to our language to just go to the store and buy a can of paint. But before the early 20th century, one couldn't just buy paint off a shelf. A professional painter would need to come, and they would have a hard mass that they would mix, and they would mix pigments into the whites, and only a professional could do this. While at the time when Picasso actually takes interest in this material, many artisans and craftsmen in Montmartre, where he was, were able to get this paint and use it in their craft. And certainly, the possibility of making this new material came from technological developments. Technological developments in the way of grinding pigments, technological developments in the way of treating the oils. So Professor Walter mentioned this ancient processes of heating up the oils to about 100 degrees with various dryers. Basically, the Ripollin paint that we are interested in uses the same linseed oil, but this paint dried very quickly, and the way that the technologists of the time could do this was by heating the oil at very high temperature, up to 300 degrees C, and then adding some hard resins, copper resins, pine resins, so that to obtain such enamel finish. And we've actually done quite some work to reverse engineer this paint, and I'll talk about it later. Certainly, although we're still trying to find the secret of the Ripollin paint, the company became extremely popular, not only because they were among the first, and here you see various other brands of enamel paints that were available in the early 20th century. Some of them we still remember. Sapolin is particularly well known. It was used by other artists in the US. It was produced in the US and France. It was used by de Koning, for example, later on. But it's also very more famously known because Marcel Duchamp did a riff a little bit on Apollinaire and changed the advertisement for Sapolin to read Apollinaire enameled. And Picasso himself used Valentine and Avi, but none of these brands really reached the pinnacle of fame and widespread distribution that Ripollin had. The company made very many types and lines of paint. We interest ourselves mostly with this oil-based type enamels. Ripollin Express and Ripollin 500, which are also brands that and types of paints that Picasso used, are based on new synthetic resins. They're based on alkyds, and they were more popular in the 40s and 50s. And chemically, it's very easy to distinguish those paints from traditional oil-based tube paints. So we really focus our attention on the ones that are based on basically the same ingredients as a tube paint in order to be able to distinguish the two. It's not really easy to research these paint formulations through the archives. In 1904, the Ripollin factory burned down, certainly, no doubt, because of this very high temperature at which these highly flammable materials, the resins and the oils, are heated up. And the archives were burned as well. And then the company has been constantly acquired and changed hands, and so the records are incomplete, and the paint was being reformulated. So it's not only through archival research that we can discover how this paint was made. As again, I have to remind my US audiences, but certainly not here, that the company still exists as part of PPG. And after some years, they took an interest in our research, and in fact, they now include a little bit about the history of the company, and some of these images actually derived from our collection at the Art Institute. So before we started researching chemically what Ripollin paint is, it's really the visual identification that was mostly used. And these enamel paints, these oil-based enamel paint, have a very fluid look, as opposed to the artist oil that Philippe Walter described so well, that retain the buttery consistency and the mark of the brush. Typically, the use of these enamel paints, in addition to the gloss and the smooth surface, have also been identified through the presence of pinholes. the presence of wrinkles and of drips. And it's very interesting that we have many, again, archival testimonies of how Picasso really delighted in these accidents that were due to the technology. Françoise Gillot, who was the artist's companion after the 40s, talks about how he Ripolin was supposed to be used on panel or on metal, and when you use it on canvas, it would wrinkle like an old apple, and how Picasso really liked these accidents and the creative opportunities that it would bring. And similarly, in 1953, the poet Jean Cocteau, who was a friend of Picasso, visited him in the south of France, in Valaris, and while the artist was working on the famous cycle of the War and Peace, and saw that there was this very quick application with drips all over, and asked Picasso about this. And Picasso said, "You don't wipe the tears away from someone who's crying." So really, here is an example where the technology is allowing new expressive possibilities to the artist, and the artist really seizes these opportunities. And then because the paint is very fluid, sometimes we have these marbling effects that happen, and the paint sort of mixes together naturally. So I spent quite some time describing the visual characteristics of this enamel paints. And here you see a beautiful example, this time by Picabia. Picabia had totally different motivations for using rippling. For him, it was a Dada act, but anyhow, you see how the surface wrinkles beautifully. But because as chemists, as scientists, we often question what we're seeing, we wonder, can you actually simulate this appearance by mixing traditional materials? And this is where the detective work starts. And in fact, again, we have archival testimonies that say that Picasso sometimes referred to, and in talking again with Kahnweiler about paintings, said he wanted the dealer to show to Shukin, who was a famous Russian collector of his work. He said, "Has Shukin seen my rippling paintings or genre rippling?" So already the artist was associating, differentiating between a rippling look and rippling paint. And so we made some experiments. What you're seeing here is traditional oil paint from tubes, where we had an increasing proportions of a resin, of a resinous material that is called Cicatrice de Harlem, that Picasso himself, we have evidence, ordered. And if you add increasing percentages of this medium to the paint, you get the same fluidity. You get the same pinholes. And after a few months of aging, you also get the wrinkles. So certainly the look is an important first step, because Picasso was so productive that we have to start somewhere. But definitely there, we realize there's something that the analytical chemistry can help us in determining where we have, in fact, occurrences of Ripolin or not, so that we can give this information back to the art historians, and with scientific-based identification of these materials, they can start thinking of the whys, of why Picasso used this material at different times in his career, because there are different whys. I talked about this anti-establishment acts of the beginnings of the twins, but sometimes this paint dries much faster than traditional oil paint. And so when he had an exhibition coming up very quickly, he would rather paint with this also because it dried fast and you wouldn't risk smearing the paint like you would with oil paint. As Professor Walter said, it could take a day or more to be dry to the touch. And actually we know from analysis that traditional oil paint can take more than 30 to 100 years to be completely cured. Yes, you put your hand on it and it feels dry, but inside the chemistry is still happening. So we decided to have a two-pronged approach to this problem by not only studying chemically the paint itself, but also not discounting the rich technical manuals on industrial production of the time, because those can really help. As scientists, we work on cultural heritage, and so we need to actually draw information from a variety of interdisciplinary sources. The first thing that we needed to do was to acquire a collection of the original material, because of course we wouldn't test our methods on samples of Picasso's paint. And I have to say, I didn't think when I took my position at the Art Institute that one of the things on my job description would be shop on France eBay. But in fact, this was a great source of both brochure and cans of paints. And we have done a lot of research to be able to date the different brochures because, of course, we're interested in understanding how much the composition changed over the years. And what is very interesting is that although the company had production in various countries, in Spain, in the UK, in France, of course, very importantly, the brochures are different when they are productions of different countries. But in France, the layout is always the same. The numbers are always the same. Some of the pigment composition changes a little bit when new pigments become available. But what is also wonderful for us is that these brochures actually contain real paint, as opposed to when you go to a store now, you get some paint samples and they're printed. They have nothing to do with the original composition of the paint. So we have a multi-step approach where we start with a non-invasive mean of analysis, meaning we don't need to take a sample. And this technique uses X-ray and excites the fluorescence of elements in the paints. And it's already a very good first step because here I'm showing you two kinds of paints. Actually, I'm very grateful. These two kinds of paints were in the studio of Vasily Kandinsky in Neuilly in Paris. And I'm grateful to Veronique Serrano-Stedman and Geraldine Guillon-Chavan for giving us access to these paints. But even if you are not a particle physics expert, you can see that the Valentin paint has a component, a titanium white, that is pretty significant here. And on the Ripolin, there is not that much. And on the other hand, the Ripolin has a lot of zinc, this zinc oxide base white that is not present in the Valentin paint. So already this first technique that doesn't require to take a sample can help us at least point in the direction of where Ripolin was used. And then if the non-invasive techniques seems promising, then we need to take a sample, a microscopic sample. Fortunately, as I said, a lot of this paint drips, and so we can take a sample from the edges away from the area of the image of the paint to learn more about how the paint is made. And then Professor Walter has mentioned this, how paint is a very complex mixture of several components. We have pigments and some material to bulk up the paint that has no color, and then we have the dryers to speed up the drying, and then we have all the organic components. So if we focus about the composition of the paint, we find that mostly the Ripolin that was made in France contains zinc white. This is very important because France was actually one of the first countries in the world to ban the use of lead, this beloved lead white pigment that the artists really liked, especially in architectural paint. And something that is amusing, at least for me, is that when the Ripolin paint was actually first distributed and then produced in the US, the lead goes back. And for many years, the Ripolin paint that were distributed and produced then by Glidden, this American company, put back some lead because, as we've heard before, the lead speeds up the drying and also is a beautiful color that is much warmer. And actually, this is another thing, that although the zinc white was commercially available since the end of the 18th century and then starts to be introduced in paints in the late around 1830, the paint manufacturers didn't know how to make a good paint. It didn't give a good white, it didn't give a good coating, and it's only when they learned how to grind it with the binding media to make a very nice enamel that this becomes commercially viable. Also, one myth that many people have about house paint is a cheap material. It's probably full of extenders. And in fact, Ripollin was probably also so popular because it didn't have much extenders at all. It was a very high quality paint, and because the pigment concentration is not diluted by these extenders, you just needed one coat of paint and you were done. So there's definitely an interesting technological aspect, although very interestingly, last week, Dominique Senelier brought to my attention that maybe Ripollin was using the zinc white as an extender, which is an interesting thought. Things that you learn when you talk with paint manufacturers. I won't bore you too much with the colors, but what I want to sort of point your attention to is that in general, the colors that are used are very, for the majority, they are inorganic pigment. These are stable to light. Only in the 20s, they start adding some organic yellows, and they have a couple of organic reds. And here again, many other brands of paints that were not so concerned with the durability of the color used a lot of organic dyes that would fade very quickly. So this is another unique thing about Ripollin. And also, it's very interesting but not surprising that all the secondary colors, the violets and the greens, they don't use purple or green pigments as the artist tube paints would, but they're mixtures of blue and red and blue and yellow. Technologically, another aspect that is very interesting about the Ripollin paint that we've been able to study in detail, and what you see here are images that you get a very high magnification with a scanning electron microscope, the Microscopie Electronique Balayage that you have seen before. This is a comparison between Ripollin with another brand of house paint of the time, Bengalin, and you can see very well how the particle size is very small. It's very homogeneous. As I said, there are no extenders. These are examples of ultramarine blues from different tubes, Lefranc and Bourjois, and you can see all the extenders and how the particle size varies. And also what is quite amazing is how the particles are very well distributed in the medium. And this may be another of these technological secrets. Maybe this would be the secret. If you read the technical manuals, they would recommend to mix the pigment together with the medium, just a little bit, and form a paste, and let it mature. What does it really mean, let it mature? As we've seen with the recipes of Pliny, we have to, with our own chemical knowledge, try to understand chemically what's happening. And what's happening is that the oil reacts with the pigment, and the fatty acids that we've heard about before basically coat each single particle of pigment so that they can be well dispersed in the medium as opposed to all coalescing together and creating lumps. And as well, this paint would dry in about 3 or 4 hours because of the cooking of the oils. And then basically you had already a polymer network, something that was already half solid, almost like a gel, just diluted in turpentine that you would apply, the solvent would dry. It wasn't a chemical drying, it was a physical drying. Just the solvent would dry and the material was already almost there, ready to dry. If we go with even a more powerful microscope, a scanning transmission electron microscope, we start again to see also how important was the shape. This is a tube paint, this is Ripollin, and you can already appreciate that the particle size is much smaller. Zinc can come from different areas, and so we became curious. Can we maybe differentiate Ripollin paint from tube paint based on the impurities on this, of this zinc? Because again, there's this conception that house paint, it's a commercial material, probably it will have much lower quality paint. And there are two processes to actually make zinc oxide. One is the French process. It comes from the pure metal. You heat it up, you get a very, very pure pigment. And on the other hand, there is a direct process that comes from the mineral. Franklinite is a zinc carbonate. It's the American process. It tends to be more impure. You can see from this, these are stills from a video, a Ripollin video, probably dating to the 30s or 40s, we don't know. And you can see, though, that they cite very, very many places for where their zinc oxide was coming. To really do understand what the impurities in each particular particle of pigment was, and here, because we're really reporting on the most cutting-edge technology, we had to go to Argonne National Lab. It's a synchrotron, like the synchrotron Soleil that you have outside here of Paris. It's a particle accelerator. It's the only place where you can actually zoom inside each one of these particles with very, very high resolution and see what the impurities are. And we were able to determine that actually there's not much lead, not much cadmium. There's impurities that will make the color a little bit yellow. And there were cheaper grades of zinc oxide that had a lot of these impurities. And instead, the Ripollin paint doesn't have that. And so we were able to prove that the quality of the zinc white pigment that is used in the fine artist tubes and in this enamel paint is the same. Of course, the manuals also talk a lot about the percentages of the pigment with the binding medium. And this, of course, has to do, again, with how the paint would spread. And we used a technique that is called thermogravimetric analysis. It's a very simple technique. You basically put your material on a scale, you heat it up, and whatever is lost here is the binding medium. And you can see that if we compare the tubes with the Ripollin, Ripollin has much more medium compared to the pigment. And it actually, the percentages that we find conform very well to what was recommended as the best proportion for enamel paints. We also wanted to know exactly what was it about the medium that would make it dry so fast. And we used another technique that is called electrospray ionization. The only take-home message that I want to search you to have here is that we have demonstration from the paint itself that the medium was heated up at very high temperature in the absence of oxygen to create already something that was almost like a plastic medium. And then with different colors, this is a chromatography graph, as you've seen before, where we can sort of start to understand how much was the oil and how much were the other components. Here you see some specific markers for resins, pine resins, and actually resins were added in very high quantity for cheap grade enamels. But here we see that at Ripollin, there's very little and a little bit more with the dark color paints. So in essence, with our study, we've really been able to uncover many of the characteristics of this paint. And what is very interesting is that the way that they formulated the paint at Ripollin conformed very well with what the manuals were identifying as the high quality attributes of enamel paint. So for gloss, of course, this mixture of the heated up oil together with the resins. Color retention means little use of organic pigments. Hiding power, we talked about this, very little extenders. So you can see also how the paint was really formulated to adhere to this criteria. And it's also very interesting that this paint was marketed as very hygienic because it would give a very, very shine and glossy and non-cracking finish. And it would not darken like lead white paint that when exposed to sulfurous gases in the atmosphere could turn dark in architectural applications. So now we have a way through all these types of non-invasive and micro-invasive analysis to identify where we have Ripollen. And again, this is not only an exercise in chemistry, but it's also a way to be able to give to art historians new tools to precisely identify where Picasso used this material. But now that we've developed the method, we need to actually test it in real life with actual case studies. And we were fortunate that many institutions collaborated with us. Today, I'm going to just focus on two cases, some of the paintings that we have at the Art Institute in Chicago and the case of the Musée Picasso in Antibes. So although we have a very rich collection of Picasso paintings in Chicago, the Art Institute in Chicago was actually the first museum in the States to acquire paintings by Picasso that we showed during the Armory show. We had two paintings that had been identified by our conservators and the art historian Marilyn McCulley, who was consulting with us on this project. They had those visual characteristics that we tend to associate with Ripollen. And so the art historian threw the challenge to us, can you tell me if really there is Ripollen here? And in this case, again, you can see the flat brush strokes and the sort of low impasto of the paint. So if we look at still life from 1922, here you see one of those cross sections that you are now familiar with when we embed in resin a sample. And we actually discovered that there are many pigments, lead white, viridian, vermilion, that are not represented in the Ripollen gamut of paints. So we can exclude that here we have Ripollen because of the materials, because having studied the materials really well, we know that these pigments and in these combinations were not represented in Ripollen. So in this case, it's probably one of those cases of the picture's genre Ripollen, where the artist is really trying to just mimic the surface, but it's not Ripollen paint. In the case of the Red Armchair from 1931, the visual aspect looked promising. We found zinc in many of the areas. But for example, in the purples, we did find some cobalt violet. And if you remember from what I said about our study of the pigments in Ripollen, they use the purples were always mixtures of blue and red. But we still couldn't reconcile very well how the whites really seem like the composition matches Ripollen very well, but we find this pigment. And again, I'm grateful to Marilyn McCulley to have pointed us to this account by Roland Penrose, who was a friend of Picasso, and he reports Picasso saying, nothing was a better basis than Ripollen mat, which he used mixed with ordinary oil color. It dried fast and became very hard. He produced pictures thickly painted in 1934 to prove his point. They were as fresh as ever and no signs of a crack. He said that this had given new possibilities to painting. The limits of oil paint from tubes had been reached. So this, for us, often in scientific research, you sort of are in the darkness, and then you have an eureka moment. And for us, this was the eureka moment because it made us realize Picasso is taking a can of white Ripollen matte and squirting in a tube of cobalt violet paint, because actually, if you read the Ripollen brochures, they say don't mix two paints together. And not all the, although you see all those colors in the brochures, not all of them were available at the drugstore at the corner. So he really would think creatively about this and create his own colors that would still retain this glossy enamel finish. So in this case, with the Red Armchair, I should add that we also had very, very strong indication from archival documentation that Ripollen must have been there, because there is a note of Maurice Jardot, who was working with at the Kammweiler Gallery, the Lloris Gallery, and he listed this painting specialty in the catalog as oil and enamel. So we knew also that we ought to find it there. We would think that the dealer would have first-hand information from Picasso about this one. And I would like to conclude this overview of Picasso's colorful affair with Ripollin with a very special collection, the collection of the Musée Picasso in Antibes, where we worked a few years ago. Picasso painted in the Chateau d'Antibes in 1946. This is really a time after the war. These are some of the paintings that he was doing before coming in Antibes. And in 46, he has a new companion, Francois Gillot. She's more than 40 years. He's junior, also an artist. It's really a time of renewal for him. And when he gets to Antibes, to Sophia Antipolis, it's really a renewal for him. You see this going back to antiquity themes, and definitely a lot of new energy. And in fact, this is the iconic picture of the collection, The Joy of Life, the La Joie de Vivre. And it's interesting also, my colleague, the director of the museum, Jean-Louis Andral, he has a theory that because before 46, Picasso was still very troubled. He still has the comb over, and then he goes to Paris, and he has this renewed prowess, and that has gone. I won't take any credit for that. But certainly, he has new energy. He's a father again. Francois Gillot would give him Claude and Paloma, his children. And what is extremely interesting about this museum is that in 46, I would like to actually draw your attention to this gentleman here, Romuald Dor de la Souchere. He was the director of the museum at the time, and the museum was mostly an archaeology museum. And Picasso was at the beach, and a meeting was arranged by Michel Sima, who was also an artist and a photographer, just came back from Nazi concentration camp, and he puts the two together. And Dor de la Souchere tries to convince Picasso to donate some art to the museum. And Picasso didn't want quite to do that, but said, well, I've always wanted to do a big public commission. I would like to paint the walls of the museum. And Dor de la Souchere said, come to the top floor of the castle. It will become your atelier, and you can paint on the wall. And in fact, Picasso started with this painting that is called Le Clé d'Antibes. But actually, if you have been to Antibes, the museum is perched on top of a rock that overlooks the sea. There's a lot of issues with the humidity, and so painting on wall didn't work very well. But Picasso very quickly reverted to paintings, and in a brief period of time, over 3 months, he painted over 23 paintings and 14 works on paper. And what is beautiful about this place is that it's one of the few museums where there is a genius loci. The artist actually painted in the same place where the collection is displayed, and most of the collection stayed there. Picasso brought a few things with the car back to Paris, but the majority of the work are large size, and they stayed there. Why did we become interested in the Picassos in Antibes? Because there are also there a lot of documentation, and notably Françoise Gillot in La Méditerranée Retrouvée. She mentions, although Picasso could bring his paint materials from Paris, he chose to use enamel paints because he thought that they would withstand this damp and salty air better. And in addition to this, Michel Sima has really documented very much detail all the artist's work in Antibes. And we could see in the photographs lots of cans. So it seemed like a very good place where to really look for Ripollin. Notwithstanding this, if we look, for example, on a number of catalogs of the collection, and we take just one case, this painting, The Nu Assis sur Fond Vert, and you can see that from the beginning in 48 up until the latest catalog in our time, the description of the media changes from oil oil again, oil and rippling, oil and glycerol phthalic, which is actually an alkyd type, this synthetic resin, and then rippling on wood. So there was still a little bit of confusion as to what the media were. So we wanted to see whether science could help. In addition, there had been some previous studies of the collection that mentioned that the collection had the 13 colors of rippling. And we knew just by observing some of the receipts that there were actually other brands mentioned. Here you see Zincolac. These are receipts that are kept in the archives of the museum. You see a generic Peintour Blanche. And also looking very closely at the photographs of the historic photographs, we feel a little bit like CSI in a sense. You can see that some of the cans here, you see the inverted triangles. This is actually a shot of our collection of historic enamel paints in Chicago. It's much more typical of the Valentin brand. So there's definitely was something else that was used in Antibes. And so again, we sought to see what the physical and chemical sciences could add in terms of the knowledge of this collection. And again, we were very grateful to the museum director, Jean-Louis Andral, to open his collection to us. And in the course of this study, we were able to actually test the colors on the paintings and determine that indeed Picasso used mostly enamel paints at Antibes, but very few of those are actually of the brand Ripollin. Something that was extremely interesting, though, very often when you do scientific research, you start with a question, and in the process of searching, you come up with other questions, was the issue of white enamel paints. And in Antibes, there are a number of monochrome works. Here you see this triptych of it's a black and white composition. And actually, again, Françoise Gillot comments that, especially at the beginning, le premier jour, il parla surtout de la lumière blanche d'Antibes qui exalte les formes au détriment du color. And so this is maybe why there is quite a number of monochromatic works. So again, you look at this and it looks black and white. But what if we changed perspective? What if we change illumination? What if we look at this painting under UV light? Now you start to see that there's actually different fluorescences, there's different ways that this white paint reacts with a different light illumination. And I can see this was white. I can see at least two, if not three, different types of whites. And in fact, just by looking at the chemical composition of the fingerprint of these paints in Antibes, we were able to identify four different types of whites plus a preparation with chalk that was applied as a base for many of these monochrome paintings. And they all have different compositions, and we have termed them in different ways. There is a zinc white that has only a little bit of extender, and we know this mostly by this technique XRF analysis, but also other types of analysis like UV visible emission spectroscopy. There is one that has zinc white with lithopone, one that has zinc white with no extender, which is probably the Ripollin Blanc de Neige, and the one that has zinc white with quite significant amount of TiO2. And what is interesting is that actually also in forensic science, forensic scientists use these differences in composition to identify a specific brand of paint. For example, in hit and run accidents, they would take a little chip of paint and determine which car manufacturer that car was because of the composition of the paint. It's also interesting that with white, we are actually able to have a little bit of a chronology in general as scientists. So lead white was used from antiquity. You can still buy it now as a fine arts pigment, but let's say until the 20th century. Zinc white from 1834, lithopone, which is this zinc sulfide with the barium sulfate from the 70s. And then with the titanium white, there are different forms, different crystallographical forms of the pigment, and we can actually have a date, what we call postquem. The anatase form was used, and the rutile form was used. But actually, what is very interesting and very unique is that in Antibes, we realized, based on the dates that Picasso put on some of the pictures, that these different types of whites, with the exception of the Ripolin-like white that is present in one occurrence, with the passage of time, different types of cans of white paints were used. So we realized maybe here's the possibility to do a very precise dating. And as I said, Picasso was working at the Chateau Grimaldi in Antibes only between September and November of 1946. It's often very difficult to really date so precisely anything. I also went, just out of curiosity, on the calendar and looked at what day it was on these days where a new can was opened in 1946. And most of them happened to be on a Monday, which is interesting. So here you see the collection of the paintings and painted works on paper in Antibes. And what I've listed here with the bolded date are the works that Picasso himself dated. Of course, we're clearly not challenging those. However, there are a number of other paintings and painted works on paper that I list here that had been dated by art historians. They don't have a date. They've been dated by art historians based on maybe drawings that were thought to be preparatory drawings or some other thoughts. And this, you know, all of this were painted with one type of white. This is the white with lithopone. This is the other type of white that has a lot of barium sulfate. This is the white, the Ripolin light white. And I want to draw your attention to this. Again, we go back to the Nuit assis sur fond vert. And it had been dated just by art historical studies to November. And we thought, well, you know, it uses this white pigment that is only used in September. It seems a little bit strange that this one could be dated to November. And again, this is where the help of the chemical sciences sometimes can encourage us to reevaluate also the historical evidence. So we went back to the photographs of the time. And here you see Picasso and François Gillot. Here at the back, there is the Nuit assis sur fond vert. It's clearly still the summer, his bare chest. And if you look at this work here, this is actually this painting here that was dated to October. It's not really finished. The Nuit assis sur fond vert is almost finished. So how could this be November if the October picture is not even finished? And here again, if you see here, this is another development of this painting here. I think you would agree with me that this is almost finished. This is dated to October. How could this be dated to November? And we can continue. This is, again, another grouping of works. If you look at this other painting that is dated to October, if you focus in this area here, you see, again, the detective work, that this sliver here is a white color, and here is maroon again. And here you see the Nuit assis sur fond vert. It's completed. So we have convinced the director of the museum that actually this painting was probably executed earlier based on this chemical analysis and also a reevaluation of the paintings. And we can do the same exercise with two other paintings, La Chèvre and the Nuit au fond blanc, that were also dated to November, but have this white with lithopone that was used only in October. And if we look again at the paintings, this painting is almost completed, and here we still have some unfinished portion of this painting. And here they are together completed, while the triptych that is here, dated also to October, they're completed here, is still being reworked by Picasso. So again, another case where the chemical analysis has led to a reconsideration maybe of the date of some of these pieces. So I come to the conclusion of my lecture, and I would like to just quote again Picasso in his own words. And Picasso disait, pourquoi croyez-vous que je date tout ce que je fais? C'est qu'il ne suffit pas de connaître les œuvres d'un artiste. Il faut aussi savoir quand il les faisait, pourquoi, comment, dans quelles circonstances. Sans doute existera-t-il un jour une science que l'on appellera peut-être la science de l'homme, qui cherchera à pénétrer plus avant l'homme créateur. Je pense souvent à cette science et je tiens à laisser à la postérité une documentation aussi complète que possible. Voici pourquoi je date tout ce que je fais. Fin de citation. J'ai l'ambition de croire que notre travail entre chimie analytique et histoire de l'art aurait satisfait ses voeux de Picasso. Merci.